You're listening to Yes to Employment, a podcast series that seeks to improve competitive integrated employment outcomes for transition-aged youth and young adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. At the 2018 APSE conference, the Yes Center's Dale Verstegen caught up with David Mank. David Mank is a professor emeritus at Indiana University, where he served as the director of the University Center for Excellence on Disabilities. In 2015, he was appointed by the U.S. Secretary of Labor to the Advisory Committee on Increasing Competitive Integrated Employment for Individuals with Disabilities, which advised the department on the implementation of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. They discuss Professor Mank's six keys to success in competitive integrated employment.
Stegen here, interviewing David Mank about systems change. Thank you, David, for being willing to spend some time with us talking about this topic. Can you just generally give us an idea of either some key points or a framework for systems change as you see it?
Thanks, Dale. Happy to have this conversation. It's a conversation about changing the way things work for employment. That's a topic that's been a part of my career for a really long time. I guess in the interest of systems change, I'd hit six key points just for starters. One, the importance in every state of building the capacity to deliver employment supports and services that results in outcomes. The truth is we need talented staff at the community level that are highly skilled employment specialists in order to help people with significant disabilities get and keep jobs. So when we talk about capacity to deliver, it's the human beings with the skills to work with people one person at a time to get people in the right job based on their interest and their talents. So number one, every state in the country, the importance of building capacity cannot be overstated. Number two, we need to continue to work to make sure that the way funding works aligns with employment outcomes, not just services. So creating incentives to produce outcomes is an important part of how things need to be funded. We see this occurring in some states some of the time, performance-based contract, milestones, payments based on outcomes. We've got to align funding with employment results. I would argue, I think few would disagree, that delivering employment outcomes is more difficult than other kinds of services, and as such needs to be funded accordingly. A third, continued emphasis on good data. We need to know if we're moving the needle or not. We all know that the persistent unemployment of people with significant disabilities is troublesome and has been for a long time. We've got to make sure we've got data systems that tell us where we're succeeding so that we can understand how we're succeeding and to do a better job in communities across the country. Number four, long term, I think it's going to be states' investment that matter. We see important leadership from the federal government with such as these PI grants, other parts of government that provide some incentives, assistance, and leadership. But the delivery of employment outcomes, that's the state's responsibility. And I think we need to be clear with states that it takes an investment. Too often, services for people with disabilities are discussed in terms of costs. Employment is an investment that gets an outcome that is economic in and of itself, both for individuals, families, but also for society. So states' investment is a conversation we need to have across the country as well. Fifth point, a very controversial topic right now, is the use of sub-minimum wage in America. It's an important conversation. Many people with disabilities, self-advocacy organizations, advocacy groups in states and across the country are saying we need to eliminate the payment of subminimum wage. And there are many good arguments for that. I guess I would add to that statement in this way. I believe it's important that we build the capacity to make subminimum wage less necessary and unnecessary. Because productivity, it's only in part about people. What productivity is about the intersection of what we're asking someone to do and who that person is. Any one of us listening to this right now can name 10 jobs in the next 10 seconds that we're not very good at. And we shouldn't be asked to do those jobs. We want jobs that are based on our interests and our talents. We need to discover that about people with significant disabilities so the work that we're asking them to do is work that they can do and be productive at. So reducing the use or eliminating subminimum wage, yes, in the context of building the capacity to make it unnecessary so that we get people in the right kind of jobs. And then finally, it's an exciting development with the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act and all of the renewed attention to school to work. Young people coming out of school going directly into competitive integrated employment. We do that well in the next 10 years. We're having a different conversation about the unemployment rate of people with disabilities. WIOA provides more opportunity, different provisions of pre-employment transition services, making subminimum wage harder to get to for young people that are between the ages of 18 and 24 are all important components. So first among our priorities needs to be doing a good job of school to work for young people with disabilities.
David, that's an excellent set of points that I'm hoping a lot of the PI grants can keep in mind when they're implementing their systems change efforts. I want to come back to the data. You know, I think you and I first worked together on one of the first systems change support employment grants, and that was in the late 80s. And we haven't seen the needle move on this 30% of people, particularly with developmental disabilities, being employed. What of those 6 points that you make do you think is the greatest potential contributor to moving that needle?
Well, we do need to move the needle. And what's interesting about this is the methodologies exist to work directly with people with significant disabilities. We know about systematic instruction. We know about doing a good job of discovery. We know about the importance of teaching technology skills. We know about the importance of bringing technology into the workplace, teaching people self-management, et cetera. What we need to do is to make sure all of those methods are applied in communities across the country. So I come back to 2 points that that we must pay attention to at a national level and certainly in at every state level as well. And those two are we building the capacity to have employment specialists with who are talented in place to work with every person with a significant disability that wants a job in the community? And we know there are many, many, many. So first of all, are we building capacity and taking that on as a long-term investment, number one? Number two, we have to align the funding structures with outcomes. Providing services is inadequate. Because we have to have employment services result in jobs. So incentives need to be created that advantage the provision of employment services that get outcomes. So I would do those two things. I would pay more attention to how we fund things, which we haven't substantially changed in 30 years, number one. And number two, make sure there's an investment in the capacity at the local level to deliver competitive integrated employment.
Yeah, that's great. So in looking back, I've seen particularly the VR system make efforts to go to performance-based types of funding. So, I mean, in some ways, I think they've kind of led the charge that way. But, of course, their whole mission is those 26s and getting those outcomes. So is it safe to assume that when you're talking about these changes in terms of being outcome-based and providing more incentives to high-performing providers, it's mostly the Medicaid funding that you're talking about?
Yes, VR has invested in outcome funding, and I think to good effect. But yes, for the longer-term funding, CMS, Medicaid waivers are going to have to align more with employment. Now, the opportunity that's just arisen really in the last few years is CMS showing a preference not only for integration, broadly speaking, in services, but integrated employment as an outcome. Mm-hmm. And we need to seize on that opportunity, support CMS in continuing to make changes in that direction. They do a little bit of outcome-based funding at this point in time, had indicated an interest in greater use of outcome funding, and I think we need to work closely with them to do that. So yes, the majority money, particularly for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, is in the Medicaid system. And so that's going to be the place where we need to align money with outcomes.
Okay. So a message for those states, because earlier you emphasized that's the battleground. That's where we're going to see the shift. Thoughts for the states as it relates to these notion of incentives and outcome funding?
Well, there are a couple of states, and I would encourage people to do the research, that are doing some outcome-based funding with CMS to explore waivers that already do this, mm-hmm. and explore possible waivers. Well, we know that the federal government, if a state has a good plan for how they want to use their waiver money, it often gets approved. And mm-hmm. then states are expected to do what they offered by way of those services. So I would encourage states to raise the question, what might we ask of CMS in order to create a preference for employment outcomes?
Yeah, good, good. So I want to shift a little bit and talk about the providers. Because, I mean, not only is this where we're going to see the greatest change, it be at the state level, but then if you kind of drill a little deeper, it's those provider organizations that when they have the capacity and start to get some of these outcomes, that's where we're going to see that needle move again. I feel like they're kind of caught. They're kind of in the middle. They need to keep people safe. They need to make sure that they don't have any instances that cause them to be liable in a whole bunch of different ways. And we do know that once you decentralize services and you're more community-based, that therein lies a struggle, along with the fact that they haven't seen rate increases in God knows when. So they're at the heart of the matter. We seem to be at odds, the provider community and the advocate community, in terms of 14C, segregation versus integration. How do we change that discussion? How do we get both parties to see where they agree and disagree and work more effectively together?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, Dale, I started my work related to people with disabilities in provider organizations. So I have a deep respect for organizations that have a longstanding commitment to people with disabilities and their families. Mm-hmm. It's important work. It's difficult often. It doesn't pay all that great. People that do this work every day, I have a lot of respect for. And yes, there are places where it feels like there are debates, even arguments, and that people are at odds. But I don't think it needs to be that way. I think often providers are in a position of being asked to do more or better, and nobody's showing the path of how to do that, nor saying, here's how the funding could help you do that. And I think if we're going to, and I also know a lot of providers have every intention and are making good efforts to get employment to more people and to deliver more competitive integrated employment, even while they may feel like they need to defend their segregated services and their sheltered workshops. So I think we need to be clear that if we're asking provider organizations to do things differently, to also ask the question, what will it take in order for you to do this? Mm-hmm. You know, I spoke about capacity building. Simply expecting more without assisting in building the capacity to do that, getting more employment specialists on board and trained and mm-hmm. supported to do a good job, that's important work. And it's reasonable, if I'm a provider of service, to turn to government, to turn to other agencies and say, help me do that. Mm-hmm. Help me do this very well because I want to. You know, when providers find themselves at odds with advocacy organizations and self-advocates, I think both parties need to ask why. Tell me why you're telling mm-hmm. telling me what you're saying. Mm-hmm. For advocates, I think it's important to listen to providers to say, this is where I'm having trouble mm-hmm. in delivering what you're asking. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people with disabilities to listen to go, oh, this is what it takes for you as a provider to mm-hmm. do things differently. Because, you know, in truth, you know, the provider community, we need to listen to people with disabilities because that's why we're here.
Right.
And if they're asking for something that we're not delivering, we need to ask, how do we do that?
How do we get that?
And even when people are defending sheltered work, you know, I occasionally get accused of wanting to close workshops. I'm not interested in the question of closing workshops. I'm interested in the people that are in workshops that are saying, I want something else,
right.
Which, you know, the data suggests as many as 60-65% of the people in workshops want to try a job in the community. So our the question isn't, do we close the workshop? The question is, what the single greatest unmet need of people in sheltered workshops are those that are saying, I want something else, and I want a job in the community. And we need to combine our efforts, advocates, self-advocates, providers, government, to respond to that largest single unmet need.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, when it comes to kind of a shining light, I think that statistic alone, that notion of 65% of the folks want to explore community employment. I mean, I even though we haven't moved the needle on the outcome, I think just that whole landscape of people considering this now and the expectation even of society for folks with significant barriers to employment and being employed is now out there, and that expectation is being created.
You know, the one thing that I would say to the positive, and you and I and a lot of people are concerned about the more people with disabilities working in the community. Having said that, people with disabilities working in the community are much more visible than they were 20 years ago.
Right.
So it is now common for any community member to notice that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities work in regular businesses, in communities large and small, in every state in the country.
Yeah, that's true. And another glimmer of light is the employers. I've been spending a lot of time lately talking to employers, particularly around customized employment and the services they're receiving. And this is just my opinion, but they are not the barrier. They need good employees, and they're quick to tell you that. If they can do the job, they want to hire them. It seems to come back to that capacity issue.
Employers have never been the problem. Employers want people that show up and do good work and bring a good attitude.
And
it's back to the capacity for us to understand each person with a disability and get them in the right kind of work.
Right.
If people are in the right kind of work that they can do and that they're interested in, they'll deliver for an employer, and an employer will say, sure.
Yeah.
One last thought on that. I think we just need to be clear that we're not asking employers to hire people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
We're asking employers to meet someone who's interested in working in the industry that they're in,
mm-hmm.
that has an interest and the skills to do that work. So we need to introduce Carol and Fred to employers, as opposed to this concept of, would you hire a person with disability? Let's introduce individuals that are interested in that kind of work and can be successful at it.
Yeah, and we do have the mechanisms to introduce those two for both parties to figure this out and to do it in a way that neither one has to make a decision sight unseen.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's great. So I want to finish up this podcast with just maybe a best practice, promising practice. Where have you seen some or majority of those 6 points being effectively addressed as it relates to systems change?
Well, what I find particularly exciting is where I see communities doing a good job of school to work, of identifying and knowing for a fact we've got 100, we've got 400 young people coming out of school this year. And we know how many of them want jobs in the community and the communities that are responding to that and expecting.
Mm-hmm.
In Seattle, they call it jobs by June.
Mm-hmm.
How clear can you be about purpose
in
3 words?
Yeah.
Jobs by June. So I think where we see transition work that is resulting in young people going directly to jobs of interest that they can be successful in, that really excites me.
Yeah, good, good. David, I just want to thank you for your time and, again, all your thoughts here. And and as always, the work that you do is something that we greatly appreciate and hope a lot of these states can take these thoughts that you had to heart.
Okay, thank you, Dale. And as I like to say, onward with alacrity.
Great.
You've been listening to Yes to Employment, a podcast that seeks to improve competitive integrated employment outcomes for transition-aged youth and young adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Today we spoke with David Mank about 6 keys to success in competitive integrated employment. You can find links to a longer interview with him by the Indiana Disability History Project and the full report of the Advisory Committee on Increasing Competitive Integrated Employment for Individuals with Disabilities at the show notes page. For more about Yes to Employment, including the show notes, links to resources discussed, a complete transcript, and a schedule of episodes, visit www.yestoemployment.org/podcast. You can subscribe through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app to have the series delivered automatically to your device so you never miss an episode. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a rating on iTunes. Ratings will help us get the series in front of more listeners. Yes to Employment is a production of the Youth Employment Solutions Center, the National Training and Technical Assistance Center that serves as the hub of information and expertise for the Partnerships in Employment, or PIE, state projects. The Yes Center is a collaboration of TASH and Transcend. You can learn more about TASH at TASH.org and more about Transcend at Transcend.org. That's TRANSCEN.org. You can receive updates from the Yes Center on this podcast and our other activities by following us on Facebook or on Twitter at Yes to Employment. Partnerships in Employment is a series of seed grants funded by the Administration on Community Living's Administration on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, made to states for the purpose of transforming state disability support systems to competitive integrated employment. AIDD is dedicated to ensuring that individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families are able to fully participate in and contribute to all aspects of community life in the United States and its territories. Music for Yes to Employment is an original composition and performance by Sonny Seferati, the co-director and autistic self-advocacy mentor at The Musical Autist. You can learn more about The Musical Autist at www.themusicalautist.org. Be sure to keep Yes to Employment on your list. We'll have another episode on competitive integrated employment for you in the near future.